TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Tariq Ali, Ideas for a Movement Against the Wars in the Middle East. Writer, journalist, and filmmaker Tariq Ali came to Berkeley at the end of April 2005. Tariq Ali was born in Pakistan in 1943. Educated at Oxford, he became a leader of the movement against the war on Vietnam. He's also a world-renowned scholar on the history and culture of Islam. Tariq Ali is the editorial director of Verso Books and editor and board member of the New Left Review. Here is Tariq Ali.
When you come to the United States today, you don't feel you're in a country which is at war. You just don't feel that. The war has been marginalized in the dominant culture. It's seen from time to time. The casualties are reported in the LA Times and the New York Times, and at the end of the mainstream, the news on the mainstream television channels, but that's about it. You don't feel that the population in the United States feels that it's at war. And this is the big difference, big difference with what the situation was like in the 70s, when precisely because it was a war which affected everyone because of the draft, the whole country felt involved in the war. And there were big opposition movements in the United States, people who didn't want to be drafted, people who were burning their draft cards, massive opposition on the streets of this city and many others, big splits inside the American armed forces. This time it's different. It's different largely because it's a volunteer army, and the overwhelming bulk of soldiers in this army, not so much the officers, are people who come from very poor backgrounds, who joined the army for a variety of reasons. And so this war has become largely marginalized. And at the same time, even though the war is in an early stage, it's in its third year, the proportion of U.S. casualties to Iraqi casualties is not so different from that of Vietnam. In Vietnam, the final toll was 50,000 U.S. soldiers dead, 2 million Vietnamese. In Iraq so far, the total is 1,600 U.S. soldiers dead, or something very close to it, and over 100,000 Iraqis. Marx once said, in a very memorable phrase, that history repeats itself the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. And though it was a wonderful phrase, as only he knew how to write them, it wasn't exactly the case. There's never a pure repetition of history, either as tragedy or farce, but it always echoes. And it's these echoes of history that we see in the world today. And it's these echoes which I write about, both in my fiction and my non-fiction. Iraq is not Vietnam. You don't have a unified resistance. You don't have one central political party leading that resistance. You have a totally decentralized resistance, dependent largely in certain areas. Fallujah was one of the strongest bases of it, which is why it was destroyed. Though between Fallujah and a number of Vietnamese cities, there are some analogies. Some of you might remember the famous statement made by a U.S. major when a Vietnamese city was destroyed in the early 70s. It was the city of Ben Tre. It was totally destroyed. And when questioned by the U.S. press, which was far more vigorous in those days than it is now, as to what had happened at Ben Tre, the major explained that the only way to save Ben Tre was to destroy it. Sort of an Orwellian phrase, but pretty chilling. And I thought of that when Fallujah was taken. But unlike Ben Tre, which was reported in detail, in Fallujah we had virtually no coverage at all. There is a big debate going on now whether chemical weapons were used by the United States, and there are reports that napalm was used to burn parts of Fallujah, which is ironic given that one of the supposed reasons for this war was that Saddam had a stockpile of biological weapons and others, which turned out to be false. But certainly we know who is using depleted uranium, and the depleted uranium has not been denied. And the effect that depleted uranium has both on the native population of Iraq and on foreign occupying soldiers in that country, we already got a glimpse of during Gulf War I. And this time, we haven't yet begun to see the repercussions and consequences of that. So, we have a situation now in Iraq where the occupation has gone wrong. It was, never otherwise in my mind. But I think the United States, as you know, did not expect the resistance which has come. And incidentally, the resistance does not come exclusively from the tiny group which is heavily publicized in the Western media, the group by this slightly nutty character called Zarqawi, who could have been invented by Central Casting for a role in a horror movie, and probably has been invented by Central Casting and the Central Intelligence Agency, because if he isn't a provocateur, he certainly behaves like one. But if the resistance was just Zarqawi, then there would be reason to be extremely gloomy and depressed, but it isn't. It's much, much more broad-spread than that, and it's both armed and unarmed. And the unarmed resistance mobilized 2 weeks ago, as some of you might have read in your papers, when 250,000 people marched in the central square in Baghdad and demanded an immediate end to the occupation and burnt effigies of Bush and his younger English friend. So this was a very big event and a very significant event in Iraq in recent weeks. Because however much the Iraqis may disagree with each other, I think with the single exception of the Kurdish tribal leaders, the bulk of the country wants an end to the occupation. I don't think there's any big dispute about that. How this end will come and when it will come is, of course, unpredictable. But till it comes, Iraq will continue to be a mess. And therefore, I don't particularly go for the argument which says, yeah, the invasion was wrong, the occupation was wrong, but since we are there, if we come out, it'll create a mess. But excuse me. The reason there is a big mess is because of the occupation. That is what has created the mess. That is why a savage chaos reigns supreme in Iraq today. So the notion that it would be a bigger mess if the United States pulled out would make most people in Iraq laugh. It will not be great for the people of Iraq who will then have to reconstruct their own country. But they would rather do it without Halliburton. They're quite capable of doing it. This was a country which had large numbers of private firms. It's a country which had large numbers of skilled engineers, architects, trained people. And if the West really wanted to help Iraq, they would pull out its troops and give a massive interest-free loan for the rebuilding and reconstruction of that country as the Iraqis see fit. But of course, Iraq has something else. And that's the liquid gold underneath the ground. And most Iraqis, if you ask them, whatever their political opinion, whatever their religious complexion, whatever their ethnic background, will tell you very clearly that the oil of Iraq is the common property of the Iraqi people. And they don't want foreign companies and foreign corporations to come and take it away from them, because they've been through that one before with British oil companies, which dominated it when the British Empire ruled Iraq. And they don't want the American Empire now to repeat that particular history in new conditions and in a new guise. So it's a complete mess in Iraq at the moment. And similarly, there's a situation in neighboring Palestine which doesn't get better. It has been presented particularly in the United States press, not so much in the European press, because the coverage from Israel-Palestine is much more balanced in the European press than it is here. But this notion of a withdrawal from Gaza being the new heaven for Palestine is, of course, regarded as a complete joke, and it's a grotesque joke. Because what is being intended is a withdrawal of settlements and Israeli troops from Gaza, but that's about it. Elsewhere, settlements are increasing, including in Jerusalem. Most Palestinians in Ramallah, Jenin, other places are not allowed to travel from one city or the other. Gaza will become a giant labor camp, which the Israelis will switch on and off at will, where they will use it for cheap labor, and because people are out of work, many of them will go and work in Israel, obviously, as they used to do before. So it's an extremely grim situation. And if you add to it that every single week I get emails now regularly, every day virtually, but once a week, if not more, and these are emails I get from human rights groups and the Israeli peace movement, which are shocking emails, just describing what happened at a roadblock, or describing what happened in a particular Palestinian village, where once again young kids were shot dead by the Israeli Defense Force. And you know, the reporting of this is on a much higher and serious level in the Israeli press itself than it is in the Western press. That's the supreme irony. And I often say to journalists from the New York Times or the LA Times or other papers here when I run into them, I said, all you need to do is just publish on a weekly basis one critical report of what's going on from the Israeli press itself. Just do that. And you will educate people. And say where it's from and name the journalists. No reply. One thing which I did cover, because I was very moved by it and, of course, shocked as well, is an interview that was carried out in Jerusalem Weekly, Kol Ha'ir, by a very courageous Israeli journalist, Uri Blau, he conducted a set of interviews with Israeli soldiers, but who insisted on being identified with pseudonyms, which was fair enough. And I just want to read some of this to you to show you what the Israeli press is publishing. Uri Blau, what is the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word territories? He means occupied territories. Zvi, 20, serving in the Gaza Strip. My first memory is of security patrol. You see unbelievable things there. People sitting under the bulldozers, begging us not to demolish their houses. There's a guy who lives in a tent where his house stood once, and now this tent is on ground that has been annexed by the settlement. But there are stories much worse than this. Real pogroms. Angry settlers coming out with sticks and pitchforks and burning down houses. Just like that. Roy, in Hebron there's basically a settler's mafia. No supervision. They can do anything they want. The police are terrified of them. When you go to arrest settlers in Hebron who've made a little pogrom, it's much more complicated than arresting an Arab fugitive. Little children throwing rocks at old Arab ladies, that's a common sight. Blau, how does being on checkpoint duty change your outlook on life? Erez, these checkpoints and the fact that you can treat people this way, all of this makes a guy more confident. I mean in general, not just me personally. I really don't like treating them that way, taking part in that game. Roy, when I first got to Hebron, I wouldn't open fire on little children. I was sure if I ever killed or hurt anyone, I'd go so crazy that I'd leave the army. But finally I did shoot someone and nothing happened to me. In Hebron I shot the legs off two kids and I was sure I wouldn't be able to sleep anymore at night, but nothing happened. 2 weeks ago I heard a Palestinian policeman. That didn't affect me either. You become so apathetic, you don't care at all. Shooting is the Israeli soldier's way of meditating. There are four pages of these which I reprinted, and I reprinted them precisely to show people in the West what is going on and to show it from the mouths of Israelis. So it's not propaganda, so to speak, coming from the victims. This is the voice of those who occupy. And this is not going to be a problem which is just going to be sorted out by disengagement from Gaza. There are essentially two ways of sorting it out. One is a proper Palestinian state, a contiguous with some self-respect, which can give the Palestinians a sense of dignity, and then one can begin to look at a sort of solution to this question. The other is a single Israel-Palestine with the same rights for everyone, Jews and non-Jews, whether they are Christian Palestinians or Muslim Palestinians. There's no third alternative. The third alternative means more war, more killings, more responses, more suicide bombings. It will never stop. It will stop for a period, and then it will start again. And this has been the history of this particular struggle. The Palestinians are obstinate. They refuse to be eradicated from the historical memory of that region. And who can blame them? They will not do it. So we now have two festering sores in the Arab East. One is Iraq and one is Palestine. So the situation, far from being better after 9/11, has been made worse. And as some of you will recall, when I spoke at CODI soon after 9/11, some time after, when Clash of Fundamentalisms came out, I said the only way to solve these problems is through political solutions. If you make wars, if you kill more people, you establish a cycle and chain reactions. You kill, they kill. You kill more, they kill more. They don't have the power you have, but they can certainly cause damage. And that is exactly what we see happening in Palestine and Iraq and in Afghanistan, which is barely reported now, as if everything was fine. But it isn't fine. And if the foreign troops in Afghanistan were to withdraw, Hamid Karzai, who the United States put in power there, would fall within 24 hours. I don't think it would take possibly 48 hours. Not much longer than that, because he has very little support. And precisely because he has very little support, the U.S. ambassador, who has just been shifted now to Baghdad, Zalmay Khalilzad, had opened up negotiations with Taliban factions. These were the people, you recall, who we were told were the worst people on earth. But they are now negotiating with them to try and see if some of them can be bribed back into the government to supporting Hamid Karzai against the Northern Alliance, who were their allies in getting rid of the Taliban in the first place. And as Condi Rai said, in a disarmingly frank way, U.S. foreign policy has only one basis. It's the defense of U.S. interests, which is true. Absolutely true. That is the only guiding principle of the foreign policy of a large and powerful empire, how its interests are best served. We're arguing that even its interests aren't best served by this sort of foreign policy, but they disagree. They believe they are. So you can have the same Secretary of State saying that she favors democracy in Russia and the Middle East, but when she arrives in Pakistan, she says that Musharraf and Pakistan represent a model form of government for the entire Muslim world. And she doesn't even see the contradiction. In other words, that this model form of government in Pakistan, a military dictatorship, not as vicious as the last one, I will grant you that, but nonetheless a military dictatorship, is the model form of government for the Muslim world. So what is the message? The Egyptians will certainly be thrilled because they already have one in place. The Syrians, likewise, they'll say, great, what's the problem about? And these many people in Iraq who the United States is backing, saying, if Pakistan's a model, hurrah. You know, you back us, we'll try and create an army to retain power. So this is the problem, basically, for the United States at the present time. The problem is, who is going to sort this out? Well, obviously, the people who are occupied aren't happy about it. No country likes to be occupied, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, whether it's anywhere else in the world. If this war carries on, they will have to introduce some form of a draft because recruits are drying up. People are not volunteering to join the Marine Corps. Many of them are volunteering to join the Air Force because that's safer. You know, you go up, no one can challenge you, you drop bombs and you go back to your base. But if you serve in the ground troops, there's a risk, and they're seeing the casualty figures and even more importantly, the wounded, the figures of war wounded from Iraq, which are never broken down into how seriously some of these poor soldiers have been wounded. And they're brought back into the country under cover of darkness. So there can't be too much reporting taking place. You can't see the images in the press so as not to put people off. And they're so desperate, they've started now advertising in the big cinemas all over the country. Desperate for people to join the National Guard. But once you join the National Guard, as many citizens are finding out, you can be sent off to Iraq. So even recruitment there is posing problems. And mercenaries don't do the trick. In the old days, mercenaries used to be called mercenaries. Today, in this wonderful neoliberal world, where language itself has become debased and distorted, mercenaries are known as defense contractors. But that's who they are. And they're hiring them from all over the world. Lots of white South Africans are fighting in Iraq. I was in South Africa several months ago when news came through that one of the killers of the black consciousness leader during the apartheid era, Steve Biko, who helped to torture and kill him, had actually been killed while fighting in Iraq against the Iraqi resistance. And I don't think any of you will be surprised to say that very few tears were shed in South Africa for that. In fact, one of my friends, South African friends, actually said, I'm glad there's no truth and reconciliation mission in Iraq just yet. So this is how angry people feel. But again, mercenaries won't be easy to find if the casualty rates carry on as they are. Because they are being targeted. You know, you can call them what you like. That's who they are, and that's the function they perform. So it's a mess. It's a big mess from which only the United States can extract itself. And if you recall how it happened last time when they were in a big mess, this mess isn't as big as that as yet. We have to be straight and realistic about that. But they extracted themselves from Vietnam as a result of two simultaneous battles. One was the Vietnamese, who just refused to give up. But secondly, the refusal of the Vietnamese to give up created a giant anti-war movement here, partially because of the draft and partially because American soldiers on the battlefield were becoming more and more disaffected. Lots of stories have now been published in memoirs and the like of many Marines, many soldiers actually shooting their officers in the back when asked to carry out missions which were semi-suicidal. And there were casualties within the United States for self-inflicted. So that movement in the country, when the country got fed up and said, we're no longer going to fight this war, played a big part in bringing that war to an end. And many, even though it was a war waged by Democrat presidents, first Kennedy, then Lyndon Baines Johnson, later Nixon, a number of Democratic senators played an incredibly courageous role in challenging the war and in questioning the government. I remember I was very young then at watching BBC used to relay the hearings of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, presided over by Senator Fulbright, who subjected the U.S. administration spokesman to really fierce questioning. And they were found it very awkward to reply to him because he went for them. Who is doing that today? No one. Basically, there is no opposition in this country at the level of mainstream politics, which is a tragedy, because what that will produce is a hollowed-out democracy, where the main parties just fight for power and clientelism and patronage to help their cronies and their friends. And nothing basically divides them from each other. But in the meantime, I don't think citizens of the United States, despite the fact that there's no draft, should sit still.
That was part one of an hour-long talk by Tariq Ali, writer, journalist and filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, and author of many books, among them the just-reissued Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s, and Bush in Babylon, on the invasion of Iraq. He spoke in April 2005 in Berkeley at an event for Cody's Books. In the second part of his talk, Tariq Ali takes up religious fundamentalism. You can find out more about the work of Tariq Ali on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by Tariq Ali by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.